Podcasting from Alexandria, Virginia, just a few miles outside of Washington, D.C., this is the Software Quality Today podcast presented by TX3 Services. This is a podcast for life science industry professionals about the trends and challenges of software testing and software quality in a regulated environment, and we'll be bringing you interviews from special guests and thought leaders each episode where we'll discuss the latest topics around processes, solutions, and regulations. Today's guest, Eric Staub, is here as an individual subject matter expert and contributor, and the views and opinions he shares are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of his employer, Cygnet Health. Before we get started, please don't forget to rate and subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and feel free to share with a colleague or two. And now, here's your host, Dora Gonzalez-Azevedo.
Welcome to another episode of Software Quality Today. I'm your host, Dora Gonzalez-Azevedo. Today's podcast, I'm sure you'll enjoy listening to my interview with friend and colleague Eric Staub. Eric is currently the Vice President of Compliance and Quality Management at Cygnet Health. He has more than 20 years of pharmaceutical industry experience in various GXP areas, including direct experience and leadership of quality systems development, software quality engineering, information technology, and computer systems validation. Eric is a certified quality auditor and holds a Bachelor's of Science degree from James Madison University in Biology, a Master's of Science degree from Temple University in Quality Assurance and Regulatory Affairs, a graduate certificate from Lehigh University in Project Management, and an MBA from Drexel University in Pharmaceutical Management. He's been a key volunteer with ISPE for the past 11 years, including previous chair of GAMP America's Steering Committee, and currently chairs a Software Automation and Artificial Intelligence Special Interest Group. He has presented at numerous industry conferences in addition to having published and contributed to several ISPE concept papers, magazine and journal articles, and good practice guides. Eric is a dynamic, passionate, motivated leader driven to establishing best business practices, organizational maturity, and the delivery of practical compliance solutions through continuous quality improvement. I'm always learning and inspired when I have either heard him talk or get the pleasure of having one-on-one conversations with him. So without further ado, enjoy my conversation with Eric. Well, good morning, Eric. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you, Dory.
So it is an early morning, and I know we've had some technical struggles getting together here, but I think at the end of the day, we're going to have a fun conversation.
I'm looking forward to it. Absolutely. Yeah. Technology is always fun, especially when we've been in this virtual environment for quite some time now.
It is. I don't know about you, but I've I have a teenager and trying to navigate Zoom calls and all that. And we don't use Zoom most in business, right? At least I don't. And so that was a whole nother platform I had to learn quickly.
Well, even being in technology, I still default to my daughters at some point in time, at least here.
They are smarter than us, right?
They are. Yeah. They are. I'm kind of worried when they join the workforce in the next couple of years because they are pretty with it. That's for sure.
Make us obsolete. That's for sure. Well, I'm really excited and thank you for coming on the podcast. When I heard you in ISPE this past November or October, November, I was really excited about things that you had to say, and I wanted to share your message with the greater audience and have other people hear about it. I've known you for several years. I've known you through Eric and Jason back in your work at Covance. So I would love for you to share with our audience how you came to be and what you've been doing in the industry.
Sure. No, absolutely. That sounds great. So first and foremost, my true kind of love or passion was marine biology. So I started out undergrad with a bio degree and worked at the National Aquarium in Baltimore doing QC chemistry and things like that. And really how I got started in industry was for a medical device company working in their lab doing QC release testing of medical products. And within that environment, I wasn't per se the most nimble of folk when it came to working in a clean room or so forth and so on. So they put me on the computer systems. And that was about the time where the Y2K stuff was happening. Part 11 had come out just a few years earlier. And I got involved in computer systems validation. And from there, I moved from the lab to quality engineering, and then really quality assurance for the bulk of my career, probably the last 20 years in some sort of quality assurance or compliance capacity. So from that, it moved me to several companies as a consultant, where I provided computer systems validation services and so forth. I got to work on a lot of automated type equipment, computerized systems, those sorts of things, automation, and really led me to large pharma itself and then to the CRO industry. And as I did that, I had served as kind of the subject matter expert always around computerized systems with regards to QMSs, so quality management systems, audit databases, those sorts of things, as well as the lab side of stuff. So the software that was used within the laboratories to collect the data, in particular for clinical trials. And that's what got me really into the CRO business with a few companies, really serving in IT as their in-house kind of subject matter expert around IT compliance and computer systems validation, and then to more formal QA compliance roles as an independent entity and leader within those organizations, providing oversight for the computerized systems and the IT compliance. And about that time when I joined my first CRO, which was Covance, I really got involved in ISPE and thought it was a great way to learn myself and to give back to the industry with respect to what I could have as a takeaway and what I could learn from them. So the rest is kind of history. I followed my career then to tech companies where I'm at currently now, both large and small, and continue to lead teams around quality assurance, that independent QA unit structure, and still to this day keep very closely connected with industry through ISPE and other independent organizations to really learn what is going on, how do I apply it, and then also giving back as well.
Yeah, I really appreciate your leadership in those areas. It's one of the things I often struggle with, is trying to figure out how to give back and how to start educating the next generation, and as it evolves too, right? Because we were just saying, like, our teenagers, it's just also the new folks coming on. There's so much new technology, and how do we keep evolving and applying those things? So one of the things that I was really interested in wanting to learn more about, and I thought maybe we can start off with kind of level setting, kind of understanding for our audience of what some basic terminology is around machine learning and AI, and how you see that in the world today.
Sure. So no, absolutely. So if you think about artificial intelligence in general, it's really around developing computerized systems that are able to perform tasks that are normally require human intelligence, right? So things such as visual perception, speech recognition, different decision-making, translation services, and so forth. So it's a computerized systems, or quote, the machine that mimics human cognition. And that's kind of a textbook definition. But if you think about it, and I've always loved Venn diagrams. So if you think about machine learning kind of sits within AI. So all machine learning is essentially artificial intelligence, but not all artificial intelligence is machine learning. So machine learning, when it comes down to that, and primarily that's my experience when it comes to AI, is really around learning from a set of data without being explicitly programmed, right? So there's certain boundary conditions and statistical methods that are used through algorithms, but it's an experiential type of situation where data is needed, right? And the more data you have and the better that data is, the better results you're going to get in terms of whatever predictions or things you're trying to make or find or do with the machine learning itself and the algorithms and models that you have.
So all of that, I know to some classic quality folk, make them nervous.
Yes, it does. A lot of people, and I've come across those in the technology sector, and really, you know, not only through industry is it teaching people, but also through my job. So I deal with a lot of large pharma and CROs that I used to work for, now being on the tech side of things, and it's really explaining that to them and getting them comfortable with what's exactly happening, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a staged approach where you start off with sort of what I'd call and have referenced in several articles and papers that I have read, kind of a static model, right? So it's very well controlled. The learning still takes place. There's still predictions being made, but there's a human element that's still within there that's controlling what happens, so to speak, right? Like what data it's consuming, what are some of the outputs, the verification, if you will, that takes place, as opposed to more dynamic systems where you're kind of opening the door and you're letting the algorithms, you're letting the models kind of teach and learn on their own and make some of those own, their own decisions, if you will. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's really kind of what industry would call the sexy stuff. That's the exciting things that happen from an AI and machine learning perspective. But it's kind of a crawl, walk, run perspective, right? You want to start kind of slow. And that's what I recommend. Understand what you're doing in a very static situation. And then as you move forward, you get into things such as, and not to throw other terms out there, but deep learning, right? So deep learning is then, once again, within the context of machine learning. And that's really where you're leveraging neural networks. And that's where it becomes very much black box, right? It's very hard to kind of decompose and break that up to totally understand every bit and piece that's going on there. But like I tell the clients I work with, or the industry folks that I speak to, take baby steps, you know, get familiar, get comfortable with the first thing you're trying to do in a very static situation, and then progressively move forward with more and more of the true biggest bang for your buck when it comes to dynamic systems and really that deep learning aspect.
So Eric, what are we really talking about here? We're talking about using machine learning AI in medical devices, in software as a medical device, I think would be a natural extension, right? But in medical devices as well, right? What other use cases are you seeing, or some, can you give some examples of what you
see there? Absolutely. No, medical devices, and a lot of the guidance you see from a regulatory perspective is from the medical device side. So that's where a lot of it is happening. But you're seeing a lot of it now where machine learning can better analyze mass quantities of data that is out there. So, you know, within our industry, you know, we have the products and we have all the data that, that surrounds and backs and supports those products, right? And there's so much data being collected. And this is where big data and analytics has come in to break down some of that, to learn from it. But it's still very difficult. There's still tons and tons of information out there. So one thing that I've seen in particular, and used to work with more closely, is utilizing the machine learning aspects of AI to look at adverse event reporting within the pharmaceutical industry. So typically, when it comes to pharmacovigilance and when it comes to adverse events, they're constantly being received within an organization, whether it's from a clinical trial or post-marketed products and things like that. And there's numerous amounts of data and lots of people that pour through this information on a regular basis. And then there's certain regulations around how long you have to report certain cases, you know, especially if it's a serious adverse event, you know, in order to protect those that are either taking the product or what have you. So, you know, I've seen a lot and experienced a lot, and one really strong use case is around utilizing machine learning for the processing of adverse events. And that's one of the biggest things out there that you're seeing today, I think, and that I've worked with, is really around how it how it automatically takes and processes these adverse events, whether it be through formal reporting structures, whether it be through email, whether it be through, you know, you name it, and can look at and process those cases much faster than any human can, right? So you're getting down to the nitty gritty of looking at what those adverse events are, processing them much, much quicker, and then able to draw some correlations between some of those as well. So, you know, it's just not about saving time and money and reducing your overall resource burden, but it's actually improving the safety profile of products, because you can report and you can draw similarities and connections between different adverse events much more quickly than you ever could in the past. So that's one of the biggest use cases out there. There's been a lot written on it from different industry groups. And it's really one of the ways that pharma and CROs themselves can get a large return on investment and really help those folks either in clinical trials or in the real world, taking these medical products or using devices or medications and drugs and so forth to have a much safer experience, right? And a lot of that has been happening, especially with COVID. So if you think about COVID, so many people out there are getting vaccinated, right? And there's just millions of cases of events that are being reported. So how do you pour through all those in the quickest means possible? And machine learning is one way to do that in terms of automatic case processing.
So in order to do that, and we have to take our classic V model, our classic waterfall validation approaches, right? And turn it upside down.
You do. You do. So a lot of what we know and a lot of what we've learned from a traditional waterfall perspective does still apply to some extent. However, when you come to and start to use machine learning, it's much more of an agile approach. A lot of companies have been doing agile software development for quite some time, but I think it's even more imperative when you start to look at machine learning. There's really no other way to do it. The waterfall model just doesn't fit. So there's certain things that you can take and kind of steal from that, but you got to put it into that more cyclical development life cycle, right? And as we've looked at it and studied within the special interest group I lead, it's really kind of a subsystem of your primary software or application in which you have machine learning. And that almost serves as like a secondary life cycle to the primary software that's being developed for a given system, right? So we look at it kind of as I spoke about in industry as like a subcomponent of your overall system. And that's very not only cyclical itself, but then you add that to the overall agile approach being used for the governing software or system, and you kind of got two models intertwined, right? So it becomes very complicated. And like I said, there's still very applicable historic techniques and knowledge and skill set we can use, but you got to kind of change your mindset a little bit in terms of how you think about that and really get into a more agile approach to how you do things.
Yeah. So changing that mindset, that's, you know, hard for some, and also on for others, it's actually just part of who they are. Like, so if you're talking about to a software developer, like that's just
they get it, second nature.
Right. Yeah. Right. But when you're talking about like bubbling this sort of stuff up to, you know, regulatory affairs people, and when you're wanting to talk about adverse events, like what are some of the things that you might want to share with them to help mind the gap in helping them change their mindset?
Right. So I think the biggest thing I can say or encourage is to keep an open mind, right? Understand that there may have been ways we've done things in the past, and not to be afraid to kind of reinvent the wheel. And this is something that I've talked about with a lot of industry professionals in terms of how you look at traditional software development life cycles. And you mentioned kind of the V model and waterfall and things like that. And more folks are kind of taking it to the next step, as I mentioned, with agile, but also keeping an open mind to say, you know, some of the deliverables and outputs and evidence you may generate aren't quite the same as they would traditionally be, right? So needing to look at software validation from the perspective that, do you have the traceability? Do you have the requirements and things that are specified and planned? And being able to understand that those things change as you go through this process, right? So if you're looking at software validation, or you're looking at software development and the validation of that software from an agile approach, it's very much the same as you look at machine learning. So you may write initial specifications or requirements for how you're going to put a model together, design a model with certain algorithms, but then you're going to have to go back and refine that, right? It's never going to be perfect the first time around. So there's multiple cycles, I think, within that subcomponent of machine learning of your system, where you're going to do a lot of model design and selection of algorithms. You're going to look at it from a data engineering perspective. And then as part of machine learning, there's this training element, right? And you learn from that, and you go back and refine, and you go back and continue to develop and select and look at something called hyperparameters and stuff like that before you get to a place where you're like, you know what? I think we're in a good spot and we're meeting certain criteria from a confidence interval or from a confidence level that we can say, okay, let's move forward and let's put this into use, right? So you got to really keep an open mind, look at it much more dynamically than you would a very structured step one, step two, step three, and understand that you're going to go back, right? You're going to go back and forth between your requirements and your design and your engineering and your testing and back to design to make adjustments and things like that. So traditionally, you know, being in a paper-based or even electronic document world really doesn't work. You got to utilize tools that are out there on the market that software developers already have and use on a daily basis and leverage those as part of the evidence that's in those systems as proof of your process and of the validation of that system itself.
Yeah. So I think you touched on something that I struggle with in trying to communicate around the, you know, there are great software development shops around the world, not just in life science industry, right? And so I think we need to look outside of our traditional industry, which we all know tends to be laggards on so many different levels, right? And bridge the gap and like, you know, commerce and aerotech, like there's things that are being developed and like crazy. And we just need to share that knowledge across the board or hire in from that those industries and take that new perspective.
Right. I will say that's a very good way to look at it because there are other very highly regulated industries out there. Like aerospace and like you mentioned, even financials and things like that. And they're maybe not directly applicable in terms of the pharmaceutical and biotech world, but there's a lot of good things we can learn from those people in terms of best practices, Dory, in terms of software quality engineering, right? And leverage those things within the context of our industry from a pharma and biotech perspective, and just add those elements of evidence that need to be demonstrated, you know, either to a regulator or in my case to a client, right?
Right.
So that's kind of the way we need to think about some of this stuff. And it is different. And what you need to also think about is really intertwining some of those folks from the development perspective with business knowledge in order to define what the problem is, to acquire the right data, and make sure that those data scientists on your team understand kind of both sides of the fence, right? They understand the IT side, they understand the technology side, but they also understand what you're trying to get at in your use case, right? And they understand how that data is going to be used and what that data means and the metadata surrounding it and so forth. So it's imperative that, yes, we pick up those professionals, kind of interject them into our industry, but make sure they also have a strong and fundamental foundation and understanding of where we're coming from and how that data is being used.
Yeah. So it really excites me when I hear you talk, Eric, because I'm also a little jealous because you get to work on the cutting edge of some stuff that I'm still trying to help, you know, the large majority of the traditional stuff that's out there and get them to digitize. And that process, I would have thought would have been done, you know, 10 years ago, but we're still doing the same thing.
Right. And I would say, Dory, something that came up at one of the recent ISPE conferences that I really enjoyed listening to. So I presented on machine learning in a GAMP5 model and how to apply the GAMP5 framework to the validation of machine learning and system and software development life cycles, but really this idea of digital validation, right? So thinking about what we traditionally did was we took paper documents, right, that we used to sign and we create outputs. And now we've just done that electronically. Like we're still producing plans and reports and all these things. And they're just simply PDFs now that get signed. So it's really no different than the paper we had in our hands before, right? So we need to think about digital validation, whereby you almost have like, in what was presented, and I don't want to steal their thunder, I'll give credit to them, is that you have like a digital validation dashboard where you can dig into any elements of your system or of your software and say, look, show me traceability. Show me where the testing took place. Show me the versioning and when the code was deployed and that sort of stuff. So the gentleman that presented this was Levi Shank at the ISP annual meeting just not too long ago, as you mentioned, when we started. And it really starts to change the mindset, right? And I think that's where we need to be as an industry. And that's where some of these innovative technologies around AI and machine learning really need to live in terms of demonstrating the overall validation and the evidence with it, right? And move away from the fact to think that you have to have this PDF document, right, that yeah. has everything in it. Because the point is the immediate time in which you produce that document, it's already out of date, right? Yeah. The developers aren't stopping. The developers are constantly coming up with new use cases. They're constantly developing. A new release is coming out, whether it's in a month or 2 months or 3 months. So that PDF document you created is essentially outdated from the very point in time in which you created it. So yeah. we got to break that mindset too. There's a different way to look at these things to establish the evidence that's needed in industry without creating your traditional workflow deliverables and things like that. Right. There's yeah. still a way to get to demonstrate that level of control without producing these documents that we've all been tied to for decades.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I talk a lot about that and try to help my customers with that. And I think the biggest challenge is really understanding what risk is. Right. And so something that I know near and dear to your heart as well as mine, like, you know, ISPE came out and really supported GAMP5 with a risk-based approach over 15 years ago now, right? Like, and we still, there's still this reluctance to have a common way of talking about things and put it on a risk scale, you know, that if you go to one company, one system's not ranked as a high thing, and go to another company, it's at a low. And we have all these different, you know, versions of truth, I guess, in some ways, right? And but as an industry, if we can collectively start to organize our thoughts around risk, you know, and really where is this risk really? Like, what is it? And I struggle with that, frankly.
And I think a lot of people do, Dory, and that's why you see a lot of it not being applied so widespread as you think you would by now, seeing as mm-hmm. though GAMP5 came out in 2008 with the whole risk-based approach. And really, you know, folks are a bit afraid, you know, and each company themselves have their own risk appetite in terms of what they consider as high risk, medium risk, low risk, right? But you got to think in an overall context to the industry. So is this something that is directly impacting the safety or the efficacy or what have you of a certain product or who's taking it, right? As opposed to a system that's collecting training data and not to take anything away from information related to training of employees, but it's not at the same scale as, say, a PV system or an adverse event collection system, right? It's not, or something that's controlling the manufacturing process of a drug product, right? It's not the same. Yes, it's important. Yes, it's required per regulation, but the risk is totally different, right? That's a low risk system in my mind. So it's just a matter of getting people, I think, on the same page to understand collectively what is high risk and what does it mean? And then what do you do with that to scale your activities appropriately? And I'm hoping what we're going to see soon this year is really around software quality assurance guidance, where the FDA is taking a more proactive approach to move away from some of the age-old documentation and really them themselves support more of a risk-based approach to move away from, hey, why do we spend all this time creating these documents, right? They used to be paper documents. Now they're PDF documents. And spend more time truly on the quality of the system through testing, through verification activities, through understanding data processing and control mechanisms within the systems themselves and things like that. That's really where we should be spending our time as professionals and as an industry to get the biggest bang for our buck, right? And move yeah. away from proofreading and trying to dot every I and cross every T yeah. in a document, right? That's not adding value to really anybody.
Yeah. I mean, even in some of those high risk systems you mentioned, like there are great software vendors out there that produce a product, right? And you might have a configuration specific to your company on top of that. But the some of the clinical data management systems out there are super robust, right? And the backbone of it is secure and valid. And spending time as a sponsor to test that core functionality is a waste, right?
Exactly. And I encourage our customers. I say, look, let us provide you what we do, and demonstrate to you what we do. So it takes the pressure off of you from having to do it again, right? If things that you may consider to be high risk that we've already done, sure, you may want to do it again, because at the in the end, they're ultimately accountable and responsible for the validation of the system, you know, not the supplier or the vendor, but use the vendor or supplier's expertise of that technology to your benefit, right? And that's that's what GAMP 5 has talked about for many, many years.
Forever.
Yeah. I think that's what you're going to see with this new guidance from the FDA around software quality assurance. It's more of the same. It's not some new magical, you know, insight as to, oh, now the FDA has said, it's been around forever, right? It's not anything new, to be honest with you. It's just a matter of people embracing it and understanding it and getting comfortable sort of being uncomfortable.
Yeah. It really do. You have to be comfortable, be uncomfortable. I love that. But one of the other things you just mentioned is the level of expertise. And so we hire in all sorts of expertise, right? Like, so SaaS providers and this, like, it's it, like, we are, that's how our economy works, frankly, right? We're constantly hiring expertise in given areas. And part of that kind of comes with a confidence that you're hiring the right person. You're doing your vendor assessments, right? And so I know you get vendor assessed, and I get vendor assessed, and we help our sponsors with vendor assessments. And, you know, I think it's also how to do those vendor assessments need to be maybe
involved. And that's where companies need to look at, you know, the people they're sending to assess their vendors, typically their quality assurance, their compliance departments, need to interact, I think, more closely with the team that's going to implement the system from a project management standpoint, to look at, you know, what does this vendor do well? What does this provider not do well? And what can we truly leverage from them, right? So there's too much of a checkbox mentality whereby, you know, compliance or QA goes out and says, oh, we did our audit. Here you go. Here's some findings. Okay, but what does that mean in the overall context of them implementing our system or implementing the system that they've chosen, right? What does that mean in terms of what they need to do and maybe what they don't need to do? So I always encourage folks, and at my current company, we get audited weekly. And it's amazing to see the disconnect between sometimes who audits us and then the project teams who are doing business with us. And those groups need to talk. They need to talk much more succinctly to understand, here's the outcome of our supplier assessment or our vendor audit. Here's what we feel is of risk to us. And here's what we feel we can simply take from them and leverage wholeheartedly, right? Because that's where the real partnership comes in, is to look at it and say, hey, we like what you're doing here. So we're just going to kind of accept that and move on and take it for what it's worth. These other areas, we're not so comfortable. So what can we do to work together to get us more comfortable? Right.
Yeah.
So I think that's, you know, and I've already encouraged when I was in large pharma, you know, send my validation team members out with the QA auditors so they can look and understand what they do well or what they don't do well, because we want to ultimately ease the burden of what we need to do as a sponsor. And the supplier should be willing to work with you to be able to make that happen. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And that extends to the ongoing run operation, right? So what does that support look like? Ongoing upgrades on, like, all of those other things that go beyond just the initial implementation. I know that there's lots of, you know, every company kind of sees what run is in a different way, right? And we need to really be on the same page before you sign up with somebody.
For sure. For sure. That's extremely important. That's something I try to encourage every day with the sponsors and the clients that we work with, to take a look at those things. And we may do things slightly different than they do, right? But in the end of the day, we have 100 customers. We can't have 100 different flavors of how we do things. So, you know, it really is a partnership between those clients and those customers and their suppliers and vendors to work out and connect the dots between those two areas, between what they do, what you need, and what collectively works for both organizations. And that's where I really think the collaboration between QA departments and compliance entities amongst companies from a tech and from a pharma perspective really come into play.
Cool. So you just started a new special interest group recently, right? It's been
a year or two.
A year or two now.
Okay. Pre-COVID kind of lockdowns and things like that. I did start a special interest group around software automation and artificial intelligence with ISPE and in the GAMP community of practice. That's correct.
And how does that relate to, is that part of the 4.0 initiative, Pharma 4.0?
Yeah, it pulls into Pharma 4.0 initiative. And this is some, or these are some of the contacts I made at the last ISPE annual meeting this year, whereby, you know, they're thinking about new innovative ways to approach pharmaceuticals and in the development processes and how that ties in with computerized systems and what we're trying to do from an AI perspective, from a machine learning perspective, to embed those systems into those processes and look at the holistic validation of those systems in a new way, kind of like what we already talked about, right? Moving away from the waterfall traditional kind of model, still leveraging the best practices that have been there, right? And that are still applicable, but doing so in a much more iterative fashion. So that's really where the two kind of cross over. And I have a lot of folks on my, or on the special interest group that are in Pharma 4.0, and we do collaborate quite closely. And I saw some of that in real time at the annual meeting this year.
Cool. So what are some of the, you know, kind of, if you were to put on your visionary hat, what are some of the things, predictions or things that we need to be kind of looking for in the future here?
So in the future, I would say, you know, when we started the special interest group, we were really just about kind of educating ourselves and getting people that knew even more than the few people that I originally collected to form the SIG. Now we're in really a place where we're starting to put out our own kind of advisement. We're putting out our own articles. We're putting out our own information in terms of some of the other good practice guides through ISPE around machine learning. So the Data Integrity by Design guide that came out has a machine learning appendix in it, right? So now we're trying to really advise and develop use cases that are applicable within the life sciences industry and share those at the annual meetings, like I did, you know, some of the lessons learned from my previous lives with organizations. So I think one thing you can really see coming out of the SIG itself and into industry is a lot more guidance around different AI maturity models, kind of like what I presented at the ISP annual meeting around how do we look at this from a GAMP perspective, risk-based validation of machine learning and different use cases that has actually been already done, right? Mm-hmm. So really a lot more guidance will be coming out, particular to this space for industry. And stay on the lookout, because I think it's going to be early in 2022. You're going to see some good stuff start to emerge from an industry perspective. There already is some good stuff out there, so I encourage people to look around. But I know what we're doing in the SIG, and there's going to be some good articles, some good knowledge base learnings that will be coming out and being published in early 2022 and into the near future.
Cool. So what do you have some, if volunteering or participating in ISPE, those are some of the things folks can do. What are some other things folks can do to get educated around this area?
Just keeping their eyes and ears wide open. There's always stuff coming out. ISPE is a good way, but there's a lot of other great organizations out there that provide opportunities to learn and hear more about what's happening in this space. More and more regulators are coming out with guidance, you know, just not the FDA, but the MHRA, the EMA are doing a lot of stuff. There's a few regulators who have participated within our SIG, who I stay connected with in terms of what they're doing. But really, just keep your eyes and ears wide open, because more and more comes out and it's easy to miss. But stay connected with the regulators, stay connected with various industry organizations as stuff starts to come out slowly, you know, and comes out more and more, I think, rapidly as we move into next year. And that's something we do as a SIG. We educate ourselves and people bring to the table, hey, this is out, that's out. You know, how do we take this into consideration? And the SIG itself is about now 50 members strong. So we have quite a bit of participation across the industry from large pharma to small biotech, consulting companies, tech companies like myself that I work for that provide e-clinical solutions and other type of technologies. But really, It's something to look out for. It's something to stay connected with. And we're continuing to try to do everything we can to educate people and stay involved and engaged, you know, through whatever channels possible.
Well, Eric, I always learn something new when I hear you speak. So I want to thank you for that.
Sure. Absolutely.
And thank you for your time today, as before this holiday comes up, and I hope you get to have a rest, well-deserved rest.
Thank you. I plan to enjoy some family time. My daughters are home from college, and we look to have some fun, at least as much fun as possible, given the current world events and things like that. But I really do enjoy, I'm very passionate about this topic. I've always looked in my career to learn as much as possible and always be a lifelong learner, whether it's formal education, whether it's involvement in industry. And I guess, you know, if I could say one other thing, that's my best advice to anybody out there trying to establish themselves within industry is learn, never stop learning, never stop reading, never start looking to ways, never stop trying to look for ways to connect with people, because that's where some of the best knowledge that I've gained on some of these topics has come from. You know, people way smarter than me, right? I give credit to my kids every day. They're way smarter than me. Yep. And I just try to make those connections, talk to different people, learn as much as I can, and connect the dots. I mean, that's really what it's about in industry and what we do as a special interest group and what I've done in my career. So, you know, if there's one thing I can kind of pass on as a tidbit of information and advice out there to other professionals is never stop learning, keep connecting with people, and just keep that as a part of your day in and day out regimen.
Well said. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you. Greatly appreciate the time today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Software Quality Today with Dory Gonzalez-Azevedo. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, tx3services.com, to your friends and colleagues. And please feel free to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you subscribe. Also, be sure to check out our archive section on our website for previous episodes. You can also check us out on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter at TX3 Services. This has been a TX3 Services production. Join us next time for another edition of Software Quality Today.